The Power Breakfast Show on radio you can watch. Power 102, empowering you.
All right. 23 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock, of course, topic this morning, Clico. And of course, we do have Peter Pommel and joined now by Mr. Afra Raymond. Good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Good morning. Thanks for having me on Power 102 once again. Welcome to the colleagues. Welcome to the listeners.
Yeah, so thank you so much for joining us, Afra. And of course, Peter is here. So we were talking Clico and where it's at and the cautious optimism that policyholders have that this government is going to deal with the issue. But you know what? One question before I segue to procurement, which I know is your, which I know is part of your thing, because I find I'm getting mixed signals with regard to procurement. But anyway, politicians are politicians. But anyway, with regard to Clico, the cautious optimism, and you didn't want to treat with the government as yet in terms of pressing them because they had the budget. To deal with, which is what you indicated. But the central bank is ultimately in charge.
Well, yeah, the central bank is ultimately in charge, but you recall that when the government made the offer to the policyholders, the government effectively, the policies that those policyholders owned were assigned to the government. So right now the government is effectively standing in the shoes of those policyholders vis-a-vis any contractual liabilities that Clico has for them.
Also, that's what the Minister of Finance will now
Yes. And what has happened so far is that the $7 billion that the government would have gotten in March, that did not include, that payment wasn't based on the contractual liabilities of Clico to the policyholders. Because you have to remember, the only way the government can make a claim on Clico is via the policies of those policyholders, the assenting policyholders who have assigned their policies to the government. The government has no debenture over Clico. There has no loan agreement that's been signed. What has been signed is a memorandum of understanding. And as an attorney yourself, you would know that is not necessarily a hard and fast contractual arrangement. And the only other document that they would have signed was the shareholders agreement, which, as you know, has gone through several incarnations, and they have been renewing. And where we are now is that they are supposed to sign a final shareholders agreement to decide on how the assets are going to be disposed of and so on. So the government is standing in the shoes of those policyholders, over 15,000 plus policyholders, and they have gotten back a portion of the money that is owed to the taxpayers based on the bailout. And it is their responsibility to ensure that the policyholders, that they get back all the money that is owed to the taxpayers, and secondly, that the policyholders are paid whatever contractual liabilities that are owed to them on the basis that Clico is now fully solvent and its statutory fund is fully funded. And I can't stop but making that point.
About the statutory fund.
The statutory fund is now fully funded and Clico is solvent.
But Afra, in terms of, because I had asked Peter concerning the issue of financial regulatory frameworks,
yes,
to prevent issues like this reoccurring within the Trinidad Tobago financial landscape.
Yes.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, it's a big question, but I think that the first starting point, Richard, would have to be that we need to get a completed report from the Coleman Commission of Inquiry. There was a very alarming newspaper report on the 26th of June this year in which Sir Anthony Coleman, QC, who was the person who was appointed to do the Commission of Inquiry into the collapse of CL Financial and HCU, lamented to the press roughly 4 months ago that the administrative support, the legal and administrative support he needed to complete his work, because the hearings have been completed 18 months ago, but in fact, to complete the report, he doesn't have the necessary support. And what became clear to me, I wrote a newspaper column in protest about it, what became clear to me is that the Commission of Inquiry is effectively being starved of the required resources. And let us note carefully that the Hindu Credit Union report, that part of the inquiry was completed, that report was published last year, I think in October, and it's 384 pages long, very necessary reading for those of us who want to understand what went wrong and how it went wrong, very important reading. But the Hindu Credit Union report was
nearly 400 pages, 384 pages, it considered a situation where some half a billion dollars, $500 million, apparently had come off the balance sheet as a deficit that was in that company. In the case of CL Financial, as we know, it's a figure north of $25 billion. So it's a considerable amount increase in terms of money that has been lost. And one has to contemplate how large that report will be. As you would know, Richard, before Sir Colman can prepare his report, the Salman letters have to go out to the parties about whom there are serious concerns. One of the points Colman made in the article of 26th of June is that he doesn't even have the resources to prepare the Salman letters. The Salman letters have not even been prepared. That's how badly off the situation is. And Colman was saying that he thinks, with the limited resources he has in hand, he thinks that in about 4 months, he could get the Salman letters done. So we are really facing, in terms of learning from the lessons, which is the foundation of your question.
Yeah.
You were talking about learning the lessons from the disaster. We are really facing a situation where we have to ask ourselves the question, do we really want to know what happened? My answer is yes, that's what I vote for. I want to know what happened. I want to know who did what, how it happened. Of course, there will be gaps because Mr. Mondai didn't come, Mr. Dupree didn't come, Mr. Mariana Brown didn't come, Mr. Conrad Enil didn't come. Mr. Danny Montano didn't come. People, certain important people who had information, and so they didn't come. But certainly we need to get the Colman report completed and published so that we can get more understanding of what went wrong, and that will give us a roadmap, I feel, about what gaps exist in regulations and so that need to be satisfactorily closed and so on. But without that report, we're really dwelling in a land of speculation.
Sure,
that's my
In terms of but. Since you wrote that article, has there been any movement with regard to the issue?
Not as far as I know.
So the situation,
as far as I know,
continues.
As far as my information is, the situation is pretty much a logjam. And in fact, the thing Colman was complaining about, which I thought was scandalous, without getting into names, what he was complaining about is that some of the key attorneys who had been assigned to work with him, in other words, the attorneys to the inquiry, not the attorneys of parties,
yeah,
the attorneys to the inquiry, some of them had simply been telling him they're too busy. To continue, as far as they were concerned, that was a finished exercise. So in fact, he needed assistance from his professional staff to do these important things like write the Salman letters and compile evidence and compile notes and so on. And they were saying they're too busy, they've gone on to other cases. So we really have a question.
But it would have been paid for that job, wouldn't it?
I don't know, you see, you're speculating. I don't know. I wouldn't go that. This is radio, they have court closing. I wouldn't go that far. But I'm just reporting what Colman said in the newspaper article. He was interviewed at length, and he said it's really terrible. He's there with a skeleton administrative staff, but the sort of solid legal support he would need to have. And he made the point, he said, if this is in London, I would have had a firm of forensic accountants. I'd probably have had two firms of solicitors assigned to me, and a case of this size, of this importance. But here in Trinidad, he had a staff of, I think, about six attorneys with the counsel to the inquiry. And most of them are just not available to him anymore. They're no longer available to him.
Well, everything heads straight back to the politics.
Indeed.
Is it that the current administration is aware of this issue? Do you have any sense of what their position is
on this issue? Well, in fact, I wrote about it in the newspaper, and I have engaged with the current Minister of Finance on another issue we'll come to later, a related issue with CL. And I haven't yet engaged on this point. And I intend to communicate with the Attorney Generals and Faris Al-Rawi and Mr. Stuart Young formally in my position as campaigning on this question to say, listen, this is a matter of serious public concern as far as I'm concerned. Mm. We couldn't have spent that quantity of money in that inquiry. I mean, on some days, there were 20 senior counsel in the room. Okay. 5 million pages of evidence. And just let it sit in a room and the society learns nothing. What does the university learn? What does the Institute of Banking learn? What does the Institute of Chartered Accountants learn? Where's the learning? Every society will make errors. Every human being will make errors. Where's the learning? And if we don't complete the exercise, let's do the un-Trinidadian thing and finish what we started. Okay? That's how I put it. So the answer is no, I haven't formally. I wrote in the paper about it back in the middle of the year. And I will formally take it up shortly. My hands are a little full at the moment, but I will take it up formally by writing to Al-Rawi and Young about it. Because it's a serious concern.
Maybe I could just come in here. While I indicated earlier on that I have given the Minister and his Minister of Finance and the PNM, current PNM administration, somewhat of a honeymoon to get that budget out of the way. Because as you know, in order to keep the wheels of the bureaucracy and everything turning, you must have money. And this budget must be passed by, I think it's the 31st of October. So, and I have no doubt that will happen. Mm-hmm. But I took the opportunity at a post budget conference, the Trinidad and Tobago Chamber of Commerce, to raise those specific issues with the Minister of Finance. Okay. As in fact, I raised the issue of the Sir Anthony Coleman inquiry. What is the government's position with respect to that in terms of getting it going so that we'll get that report? I raised the issue of the, I know the AFRA's baby, which is the question of the disclosure in terms of CL Financial, the sale of assets and the process and the proceeds and what happened with that whole issue. And I also raised the First Citizen IPO issue with the Minister of Finance. And in respect of, that report, from what I understand, has been completed. It's just that it has not been made public, or the public has not been made aware of anything at all relative to that particular issue. That is another burning issue as far as I'm concerned, where the public is concerned. And the minister's response, in fairness to him, is that we are going to let it all hang out. The question is when. So that I told him that we really appreciate his response, but we are also going to hold him to his word.
When he says he's going to let it all hang out, what that means?
When this sounds really unparliamentary, Peter, what's your language, man?
I'm quoting the minister. I'm quoting the minister. The Minister of Finance said, I'm sure the transcript of the meeting will bear me out of that. Yeah. He said, we're going to let it all hang out. Whatever is there, in other words, it's going to be laid.
What I'm getting from
what he's saying, we're going to lay the report as they did in the terms of life support. Remember, the People's Partnership would have laid life support in the Parliament for debate and so on. I would expect that in the case of the First Citizen IPO, that report, which was done at great expense, I'm sure, because they brought in the forensic auditors from, I think it was from Canada, not PwC.
Deloitte or somebody, sir?
It could be Ernst & Young or one of them. I don't want to call the wrong name. But they brought in forensic auditors from abroad. They did an extensive work on the matter. And from what I understand, a report has been submitted to the SEC. And the SEC, for whatever reason, has not yet made that report public. The minister, who is the line minister, the Minister of Finance, is the line minister for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And therefore, I would expect that he would get a copy of that report. And then he, in turn, would bring that matter to the attention of the public of Trinidad and Tobago via the Parliament, which is the rightful place for it to be done.
Yeah. But you brought the issue of disclosure of assets.
Yes.
And what assets actually the state is in control of. How are they disposing of it, and is it being disposed of in a transparent and equitable manner? What's your opinion on that with regard to CLECO?
Well, it's difficult to have a firm opinion because, in fact, there's not enough information. And this is the second point Peter was making that I've been campaigning for. I sued the Minister of Finance since 2013. On the 22nd of July this year, my lawsuit was successful to get the information. On the 10th of August, the Ministry of Finance, which at that time was led by Larry Hawaii, filed an appeal. So it kicked the matter upstairs to the appeal court. And without getting into the full details of it, I've already written to the new Minister of Finance. And I'm calling on him to, number one, formally withdraw the appeal. Okay? That appeal is not in the public interest. All I'm seeking is information. I'm not like Mr. Permel, who's seeking to get back any money. I want information in the public interest. If we want to have an educated society, we have to know what really happened here. Number two, I want him to publish all the details of all the payments, which relates to the point you're making, Richard, and the accounts and so on. And number three, the cost of the litigation, which I funded myself and is quite expensive, I want to get those my legal fees refunded. And I've written to Mr. Imbert, and let's put it this way, we're in dialogue at the moment. Okay, he's considering it. He hasn't said no and rejected it. So I'm getting more of a hearing, for what it's worth, at this moment from Mr. Imbert than I got from Mr. Hawaii. So I'm maintaining the campaign to get those things, and I continue to fight for those things. But we have a hearing in the appeal court on the 19th of October, which is next week, Monday. Mm-hmm. It's likely to be postponed by adjourned, probably by consent or something. But I'm continuing to lobby for those things, and I'm in communication with the current Minister of Finance.
Why is it that Trinidad and Tobago functions as a society where everything seems to be obscured and everything happening behind a veiled curtain? The Americans, for example, did a whole inquiry into 9/11. Volumes of stuff came out of it, an analysis of what took place. We, with regard to the 1990 attempted coup, couldn't even get that. I didn't even know if that report is even out.
No, I don't think it's been published.
Why is it that everything
I'm sorry, it has been published.
Why is it that everything in Trinidad and Tobago seems often obscured from view?
Well, as a friend of mine says, I have this friend of mine who's half cynical and half very supportive. He's my webmaster. I know he's listening. No names. But his saying is that, you know, Trinidad and Tobago is Judeo-Christian, and that's what all of us were taught, and there are 10 commandments. And he said the 11th commandment, the one they didn't write down anywhere, is thou shalt not be caught out. And therefore, we have all absorbed into our DNA the notion that if ever you do anything wrong, you shall not be caught out. If you're caught, you deny it. So there's that kind of culture of secrecy and anansi and so on and so on. Thou shalt not be caught.
Because I think for a lot of the population, we are tired of commissions of inquiry. Anytime you say, well, let's set up a commission of inquiry, I think there's a collective groan.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have not moved the society forward for all of the commissions of inquiry we've had on various issues over the life of post-1962.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Richard, you've raised a number of issues here, but before I respond to them, let me just go on record as supporting Afro Raymond's request that his fees, the fees that he would have paid, be refunded. Because Afro Raymond, and I think he, I'm sure he would want to clarify that, he wasn't acting in his capacity as the president of the JCC.
No, the JCC had
he was acting as Afro Raymond,
individual.
Civic-minded citizen of Trinidad and Tobago, who was asking questions that everybody wants to know.
Right.
And he has gone even further and put his money where his mouth is and taking the matter to court, which he won, as he indicated, in the High Court, and now the matter is being appealed. I would want to go on record as saying that matter, I'm agreeing with him, that the appeal should be withdrawn, his fees should be refunded, and this matter should be, you know, disclosed in terms of a full report and an accounting of what transpired in the, with respect to the sale of those assets.
Any reasonable citizen would object to that, because the issue of information and transparency, which comes back to the obscuring,
yes,
that seems to be part of the political culture.
Exactly, and I think you made the point earlier on this morning. I was on my way down. I was listening to you in the car, and you say that when that happens, it's a fertile breeding ground for conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And we have the highest per capita. Did you see that?
Yes.
Of conspiracy theories in the world. So this is the one case that less is not more. You need more information than less information. So that I would want to call on the authorities, but specifically as it relates to the CL Financial CLICO issue. Because, you know, there's a lot of speculation outside there as to how these assets have been disposed of and are being disposed of.
Who get what?
Because there are a lot of assets. As Afro would know, CL Financial, in terms of being as a conglomerate, was a $100 billion empire. The accounts, the 2007 accounts would bear that out.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you had about 90 something billion dollars in liabilities, nonetheless, the CLICO empire represented a huge amount of assets all over the, not only in Trinidad and Tobago, but throughout the Caribbean and so on. And therefore, these are assets that are being, some of which have been disposed of. You have some big ticket items, which would have been the methanol holding shares, 7.2 billion TT dollars in terms of what they would have realized from that.
Yeah.
You have Republic Bank shares, which is another big ticket item, you know, so that there are a number of, and there's still some other assets you have. Remember, CL Financial owned the malls. They own Home Construction, under HCL.
Yeah.
They would have Trin City Mall,
Long Circular
Mall. Well, they have disposed of Valpark. That is another questionable disposal. Some people are saying it was sold at an undervalue. I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know. But the point is, in the absence of proper accountability and transparency, you're going to get speculation. That is just the nature of the population that we have in Trinidad. So I'm saying, give the people the information and let them be able to digest it and decide for themselves whether they are, you know, whether they, if they believe that it was done properly or not.
At this point, I wanted to open up our lines.
Yeah. I want to go for a break first, though.
So when we come back, we'll open up our lines where you can get a little interactive on with the discussion.
Yep. 222 talk will be the number.
Yeah, good morning, caller. Good morning. Well, good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
With
morning.
Reference to the appeal, court of appeal of the freedom of information, I feel there's a lot of benefit to be derived if it were heard by the court of appeal, so a final position could be taken in future matters involving freedom of information. It's not a life and death situation.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, caller.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
You know, I don't understand. I mean, if we ask you for information on public money, how it was spent, this information, and they are refusing and appealing that, I mean, you know, when a project is done, when besides being the project completed, the most important thing is lessons learned, right? A lesson learned is because you look at the whole thing and everything is public and you learn lessons from the good and bad. How on earth could they refuse to give information? It's our money. God have mercy. Have a good morning.
Okay, B. Thanks, Brooklyn. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, good morning. You all talking about something important, especially I could talk to anything else?
No.
Okay, all right.
And that's what we do in stereo. Every time. Yeah.
She
got to know in stereo.
Yeah, she got that in stereo. 2-2-2 talk, 2-2-2-8-2.
No, but I think, you know, that issue of accessing information and the state blocking it is I always find that incredulous. Maybe because I just believe that once you're in government and it's the taxpayers' money, you should be transparent about whatever you're doing. So why do I have to litigate to the point of, one, having the High Court adjudicate upon it, be successful, and then you appeal? As the state, is there no responsibility on the part of the state to say, well, look, it's information that the public should be entitled to have?
Yeah, I mean, it's a no-brainer, because how many citizens do you have like an Afro Raymond who can afford to put out that kind of money? Because you're talking about, I think part of his team was senior counsel and a junior counsel to get information that is not only, not necessarily for his personal benefit, but for the benefit of the country as a whole.
Yeah.
You know.
And how transparent we are in terms of how we deal with this user.
Yeah.
And not only that, moving forward.
Yes.
In terms of what's the best practice.
Absolutely, you know. And that's why you have the Freedom of Information Act in the first place, to get information that government officials do not wish to share with you. So there's a way you can get around when they do have their post-cabinet press conference and say, no, we're not discussing that, or we're not discussing you go through the courts.
Yeah, to get
the information.
Yeah. All right. So we are still taking your calls at 222-8255, 222-TALK.
Why is it that best practice is a lot of the time something that's meandered around in terms of how Trinidad and Tobago conducts his business? What's your opinion on that?
I really don't know. I think we are unique in that regard. Most countries, you know, around the world would want to emulate whatever the best practice is internationally. And for some reason, we feel that we are, you know, we can do our own thing and somehow get away with it. It escapes me, actually, because best practice could only be in the best interest of all concerned going forward, because you set a standard and everybody then, you know, falls in line and follows the standard.
Is it that for a lot of, now, I don't know if part of the problem is that Trinidad and Tobago is a small society. So there's a lot of interconnectivity that is taking place where decisions are being made, whether it be financial. A lot of people in those circles know each other. And if self-interest then starts to play a part in terms of what am I getting out of it, and that becomes, and the public interest becomes subsumed.
I think there's a good point also, because, yeah, it's a lot of interlocking. Well, it specifically in the corporate world, you have a lot of interlocking directorships and so on, where one guy sits on about 10 different boards. So when one issue comes up here, he's over there and he's all over the place. So you also find those relationships, the boys clubs that we socialize, and when I meet you here, and we, you know, so it does pose somewhat of a challenge for people to be open and transparent and adopt what they know to be the best practice. You know, I can see that happening because of other considerations, you know, like that you just explained.
Yeah, the self-interest.
Yeah, the self-interest.
Because the self-interest oftentimes plays a part, because a lot of what, because even, for example, the decision about Clico and beyond the, and to me, you explained it the best in a sense, and you may not have been aware that you explained it. Because I think for some citizens who were not part of the Clico portfolio,
yes,
they were like, why is the state bailing out what could be considered a risky investment on the part of a policyholder? You have made a financial decision and it has gone awry because of the private institution that you've invested in, and that institution has now collapsed. Mm-hmm. Through no fault of your own,
sure,
but certainly attributable on the basis of it to management and how it was controlled and how expenditure, how investments were done, and what decisions were made at the managerial level. But yet the society itself had to pay for it as a taxpayer. And I felt, and I think that is a question for non-CLECO people who would have said, but why is the society being burdened by this? And you felt the decision was being made by people who would also have had an interest, because the Minister of Finance then certainly would have had an interest, which would have been Karen Nunes de Scherer. And of course, the then central bank governor indicated he had an interest, Hubert Williams, at the time. So were decisions being made on the basis of self-interest or from an overall view of what was necessary and good for the society? And you touched on it today when you said that it involved thousands of people who have investment potential from those assets that could build the productive capacity of the society. That, I think, was never something that was articulated for that sector of the society. You would have been like, well, what's the point?
Sure. And right.
I had a call here holding for a while. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, good morning to everybody there.
Good morning.
I think that is why these politicians keep dividing the society, so that it could do all things. We need laws in place for people to get information. That politician, why it is I have to pay tax, and if I don't pay tax, I can make a jail. And then the politician waste my tax money. Tell me something. And we just seem to be going out in circles, man. Right? They're not going to put no laws here for to humble them from doing what they need to do. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, the law is already there.
Yeah. Good morning.
Information.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. What I believe is the challenge that faces Trinidad and Tobago is a lack of maturity. We, notwithstanding the fact that a number of people would talk big, whether the economists or lawyers or politicians or what have you, we are not mature enough to actually let the population know this is the truth, this is what we have done, this is the situation that we are in at present. And because of that, we end up going round and round in circles and not really coming to the reality that, look, we need to level the population. And you get it from one person to another. You just have to look at our debate in the parliament and see the lack of maturity of our leaders in the country. And I think if we could just be more mature people and actually indicate to the population this is where we are in what we do, you know, then I believe we'd have a better country. But right now, I think, and as the caller said, we're going around in circles all the time, and that's what's going to eventually happen all the time. Everybody believe they could outsmart everybody. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Society is so cynical when it comes to people who are at the helm, whether it be of business or of governance.
Yeah.
Well, and rightfully so, because, I mean, we've come out of a period where, and that your previous caller there, I think he had the nail on the head. We have to stop, the politicians have to stop trying to feel that they're smarter than the public. I always get a sense that they feel that they are smarter than the public, so they can spin anything, and you have to, as the young people say, you have to hold that. I think once they start understanding that we are in a society now where people have access to a lot of information, and information is knowledge and power at the end of the day, if you're gonna come to the public, you have to come good. You have to come with something that makes sense, something that people can understand and appreciate exactly what you are trying to say. If you come and give people a 6 for a 9, they're going to figure it out eventually, and therefore that is going to come back to haunt you, and your credibility is usually severely damaged after that. And then everything you say after that, even if you may be saying the correct thing, they see it as being untrue. So therefore, I think this government has an ideal opportunity, having now come into office, to do and say the right things, to be transparent and upfront with the people. The gentleman spoke about, right now we know that we are in difficult times. Put the matter on the table. Let the country know exactly how bad the situation is, what are the necessary prescriptions in order to fix it. Because I think people are in a position now where they feel, look, now we are mature enough to understand that, and we are prepared to make the necessary sacrifices once it is done in an equitable fashion. Nobody wants to make any sacrifice that the other guy is not making. So once you treat people in an equitable fashion, notwithstanding you may have to make sacrifices, it is going to make it more palatable for people to accept those sacrifices when they have to make them.
Well, Peter, this is where we have to leave it this morning.
Yeah. That was not short and sweet.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Peter Purville, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And feel free to pop by anytime and keep us abreast of what's happening.
Thank you guys for having me. And thank your audience for listening.